And joining us next on our two guest episode, he is a member of the Tri-State Living History Association, Mr. Byron Cookie Vineyard. Byron, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. Now, you and I, we are going to have the opportunity to meet in person here coming up in Fredericksburg, Texas at the National Museum of the Pacific War on May 25th and 26th for their Living History Weekend. One of the things I like to do anytime I bring a new guest onto the podcast is to get a little background history onto them, what they do for a living, how they got into living history, and then where they're at today with their living history. So let's back up a little bit. What do you do in your professional life, and how did you get into living history?
Well, I worked mine construction, worked in the coal mine for a few years, and around 1983, I had the opportunity to buy a chimney sweep business off a friend of mine that was wasn't cut out for it. So I bought the business sight unseen. And so here we are, I'm in my 35th year in the business, getting ready to sell it and retire. And as far as the World War II, my oldest son, Lucas, federal police officer, he actually got started when he was in eighth grade. He loved history, especially World War II. And then when he was in the National Guard, right around 9/11, was sent to a high security detail in Germany. Long story short, I started ordering some World War II things for him because he was going to join a unit when he came back to the States. So that got me interested. So in 2002, I went to a 506 reunion at Decoa, and that's where the Band of Brothers was started. It was in Decoa, Georgia, Prairie Mountain. And so that I really caught the bug then because we were around the airborne unit. And that's our first unit was, well, everybody does Easy Company 506.
Sure.
You throw a rock, you're going to hit five units that portrays 506.
Yep.
Or an airborne unit. And so I was doing the infantry. Well, at that time, I would have been around 52 years of age. So I'm out there tripping around with airborne boots, a Garand rifle, steel pot on my head, all the gear. And I'm telling the boys, this is not for me. And so my youngest son, Brandon, who works at the Pacific Museum in Fredericksburg, he said, well, Dad, you love to cook, so why don't you do a cook's impression? Well, here we are 18 years later and several thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I put together probably, and I'll pat myself on the back, I probably got one of the most authentic working field kitchens in the United States, bar none.
Well, let's talk about that real quick. Where does one start to go down that rabbit hole to acquire this stuff? Because obviously, like you said, everybody and their grandmother, when it first gets started, a lot of the guys do the airborne. We all know about, you know, what price glory, about World War II impressions at the front and all that. But how do you go about on this venture to find either reproduction or authentic field kitchen stuff? Because not too many people do it, so there's not a high demand for reproduction stuff.
There isn't, Don, and I'll tell you, we'd have to do two or three more podcasts, buddy. I mean, it was hunt and peck. People found out about when I first started, I had very little gear. A lot of it was propane, like you had for a fish fry or a turkey fry. I was using that stuff. We were washing dishes out of Tupperware, just odds and ends. And then I just said, no, if we're going to do this, let's
do it
shoot
right
for 100% authenticity. We owe that to the veterans. We owe it to the younger generations. If you're going to, and this is where I separate myself from a lot of reenactors. If people are going to do this, why are you doing it? Are you doing it to impress somebody? Are you doing it because your friends are doing it? Are you doing it because you have a deep burning passion to keep the history alive for our World War II vets? Because in a few years, Don, you're not going to see a World War II vet.
I understand.
And it's up to us. And it's up to us to keep their stories that we've collected over the years, to keep their memory and as much original gear working as we can, to pass that on to future generations, or it'll be lost. We've got a large responsibility on our shoulders, and when that last veteran's gone, it'll really be a responsibility to tell the story at the most accurate possible way we can with our impression of a field kitchen.
Well, and not only the field kitchen, but everything in general. But
everything.
You know, I never
we strive.
I never made this equation before, and as you're talking, which was very well said, and I know you'll understand what I'm about to say. I remember when we were in school and they were talking about how rumors would spread, and the way they would demonstrate that was we'd play the telephone game. One person was told a fact, he'd whisper it in the person's ear next to him, and around the classroom, and by the time the last person got it, the fact was completely distorted. Well, we're kind of doing the same thing in living history. We're reading books, we're getting facts from veterans, they're told to me, I tell it on a weekend, another living historian hears it, he tells it. We have got to try to keep that authentic so that when the 500th person tells it, the fact's still there. We need to make sure we're not playing a giant history version of the telephone game where everything gets distorted.
Well, and that's true, and I've gotten in some pretty good arguments with other reenactors because and reenactors can take this for what it's worth, and I'm going to say it because this is my passion and I live for the field kitchen, is if you're going to do it, you strive for 100%. And we know, because we call ourselves living historians, and the reason I say living historians instead of using the word reenactor, a reenactor to some degree, and it's a large group of them, will only take their impression only so far, and that's where it stops. They don't do research every day like we do. They only live from one reenactment to another one, where we live at 365 days a year. We're constantly researching photos, manuals, videos from World War II. We talk to the veterans that were cooks in World War II. We get their pictures, their stories. We read anything that we can get on the mess halls and the supplies for the food. And we make our own labels. We make a lot of the stuff we make ourselves. And so to me, we strive for 100% knowing that we never probably will get to an exact 100%, but we're always striving, because when you stop striving for 100%, you start going backwards.
Absolutely.
In your impression. In other words, you'll show up at an event. Oh, well, I forgot this. Well, that's okay. Well, I don't have the right thread for my buttons. Well, who's going to notice the thread? We do. We get the right thread to sew our buttons on our uniform. That's why they call you a stitch Nazi. And to me, when you're called a stitch Nazi, I take that as a compliment, because that means I'm still striving for 100%, and I'm at probably 92-93%, where a lot of reenactors will stop at 70%. When I started in around 2002-2003, nobody was doing the field kitchen impression. Nobody.
I think the biggest photo I had ever seen of one is that comes out of the D-Day reenactment up in Ohio. I've only seen photos. That's the only place I've really seen one erected anywhere.
Yeah, there's a couple out there that's good. Mine is when I found the gear, none of it worked, and there was nobody to show me how to repair it. There was nobody to show me how to restore it, so I start reading on how to do sandblasting. So I've got my own sandblaster and soda blaster. So then I go to body shops and find out what's the best thing to remove rust or repair this. And I'm a welder, so I've welded a lot of stuff. I'm a painting pro. I've got my own big compressor and spray guns. And so our paints are good reproduction paints for that era.
When you media blast that, are you using walnut or using cork? I mean, because obviously some of that meat is a little too rough on it, and you don't want to create more holes than you already
cork,
have.
A walnut shell under the right pressure, I always test a little area. It's kind of out of sight before I go full tilt, and I set my pressure gauges, you know. But I use that, and then on like, because I restore helmet liners, I put in the new webbing.
Mm-hmm.
I can paint and cork a helmet just like a professional. Josh Murray, Jay Murray.
Yep, we've had him on the show.
Okay, Jay Murray, buddy. That man, he is my go-to guy. I feed Josh out of my field kitchen when he's at Rockford, Illinois, for the big battle weekend in September up in Rockford. We became real good friends, oh, God, years and years ago. and he couldn't leave his space because a lot of times he was by himself. So after my troops ate, I would always take a mess kit loaded down with food and a big thing of coffee and take over to him. I'd say, well, when you get done, just clean the mess kit and bring it back over after everybody's gone tonight, and then I'll bring it back over for breakfast. So,
sure.
So he never had to, so he's always helped me because he knows that I'm doing it just for our guys in the unit. I don't do anything for resale. If I'm doing a helmet liner, it's for one of our new guys or for myself because I've got two or three helmets, different impressions and stuff. So I can redo helmets, you know, and stuff. But I'm just taught, it's self-taught on restoring the field kitchen gear. And as far as finding it, Don, oh my God, I don't pass up a flea market. I don't pass up an antique mall. Somebody will call and say, man, so-and-so said that they saw something out in the barn that looks like a Mermite or a Mermite wow. insert or a pot or something. And I've had people actually buy stuff at an antique mall up north, and they come back down home and they'll say, hey, Byron, we found this, and you can have it at cost, you know,
sure.
whatever it is. Go and look at it. If you can use it, I'll make sure it's war dated, and I'll say, yeah, I can use that. And so I've had stuff given to me. People said, we know that you'll keep it, you'll appreciate it, and you'll take care of it for the rest of your life. So we want you to have it because we know it's got a good home.
In your experience, have you resorted into shipping stuff back from overseas because a lot of it was left there?
No, a few things like maybe pamphlets, small items that were shipped fairly inexpensive. If you go for the big stuff like a war-dated immersion heater, it would cost you mm-hmm. an arm and a leg and a stove, an M1937 range stove with burner and pots and pans. I wouldn't even want to venture on what that would cost to get it back to the States. And it's probably going to be painted green, which means it has to be, if you're going to be authentic, all of that paint has to come off. And it had a hardening agent for heat resistant. And I've stripped four of them with sandblasters, and it liked to kill me. I mean, it
wow.
takes a lot of work to get that green paint off of a 37 range stove. It's work.
I can imagine.
It is work. Yeah. Yeah.
So when it comes to, let's say somebody wants to try to get into the field kitchen, if you're just trying to get the basics down, what are the key components that you need just for the smallest, you know, smallest defined field kitchen to feed just, you know, a platoon or whatever? Just if somebody's trying to just to get one started for their group.
Well, I would say you could start out like I did with stuff that isn't from that era, but always be out there hunting, going on different websites on their where you can post a question or say, hey, I'm looking for a Mermite, eBay. But see, I bought a lot of my stuff. I was lucky. I found a lot of stuff at antique malls back in 2004, 5, 6, and 7 because nobody was buying it. Nobody knew what the real cost was. So I was picking up a Mermite like for $50. Well, now a good Mermite in good shape will bring $275 to $350. And then if you throw in the inserts, those inserts now can bring as much as $60 or $65 for an insert, and I was paying $25 for an insert.
Now, for those of you listening who aren't familiar with what a Mermite is exactly, it's kind of like a large, stubby thermos, if you will.
A heavy round thermos. That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
And
it's a big thermos.
And when you say insert, they basically have like a stainless steel pot with a lid that you could fit, what, two or three of them per Mermite?
Most of them were aluminum. Some of them were tin. They were a lid with three clips on the side. The clips held the lid on, and there were three in a Mermite. Now, in the war, they used them for two, one for food and then one in the field hospitals for plasma.
Huh.
And you could tell a medical Mermite because the lid was painted white and it had about a 2-inch white band at the base. And buddy, if it was painted white, they better never ever catch a cook using it because you could just about be shot because that was for plasma and medical personnel only. If it was solid green, a lot of times they had their division on there or the battalion numbers or whatever was stenciled on it so they knew what unit that Mermite belonged to. The cooks, what they would do is they would fill them from the water in their garbage cans from the immersion heaters. They would put hot water in them, let those get hot, and then they would put the inserts in hot water and let them get hot. Then they would put the steaming hot food in there, lock them down, put them in a Mermite, and ship them to wherever they were going to ship and feed the troops. And that's how they kept the food hot. Now, we use ours a few times in the field for taking food out to the boys on the front line in the foxholes, but mostly we use them for cold storage. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we'll take two of those inserts, put water in it and freeze it, and then we'll put food in one and sandwich it between the ice blocks, and hell, I keep food cold for 4 or 5 days.
Nice. Now, I assume with the technology of the time that the primary source of insulation in those is probably asbestos?
I think it was some type. I found one at an Army depot down in Knoxville, Kentucky, at an old Army depot. And I first thought, man, this is a find. Well, I turned it around, and it had been left out in the rain, and one whole side was rusted out. And it looked like a fiberglass, a white spun fiberglass is what it looked like.
Huh.
But what happened, we're losing the insulation property because what happens over the years, that breaks down, and it falls and settles towards the bottom. So your bottom is well insulated, but the upper part and the lid, the insulation is starting to deteriorate. So it doesn't have the same insulation property it did back in during the war in the 40s.
And there's probably really no way to fix that without compromising the casing on the Mermite itself.
Well, I've done one, and I made a mess of it. What I was using was a foam, and it didn't get all the way down in there, and I had air pockets. What I did is I drilled a hole in the bottom, turned it upside down, drilled a hole, got a Sawzall blade started, and I just cut out a nice circle. Then you'll see the insulation. Well, I pushed it all the way down to the top of the insert, and now if I do another one, I'm going to use a good R-factor insulation, and I'll just pack it as tight as I can. Then I'll put the base back in there, tack weld it, and then I'll weld it back in, and then I'll grind it back smooth, so it'll be hard to tell that I've compromised it. Plus, the bottom's on the ground anyway. You're never going to see the base, the underneath side of a Mermite.
Well, let me ask you this. Since obviously no one's going to see the inside, wouldn't a decent solution to fill in the air pockets use an expanding foam?
Well, that's what I did.
Okay.
The first time, and I even tried to use a nozzle to squirt the foam. Well, that foam expands so fast, and you create little air pockets, so you don't have 100% packed insulation. That first one I did, I thought, nah, this is not the way to go. So now I'm thinking this summer or in the fall, I'm going to go back and do another one of my older ones that's kind of beat up, and I'm going to cut the bottom out, and I'll do some research and find out the best insulation that I can put in there, and I'll pack it tight. Then put the lid back on and tack her back in there.
Let's talk menu options, because we know a lot of people think that field kitchens is nothing more than shit on shingles and some black coffee. But people would be surprised what all you can cook in that field stove, because I was looking at your website, and I was looking at a video that you posted and a few other links, and one of those links included some copies from the original field manual of what all can be cooked in those things. And I think people would be surprised what luxury items skilled cookie who had access to some decent ingredients could come up with.
Oh yeah. The cooks in World War II, they were a character all in their own. Of course, you had the K rations, you ate out of a box, and those always came to the troops. Then you had the 5-in-1 and the 10-in-1, pretty straightforward. Then you had other stuff shipped from the States, stews. A lot of it was dehydrated in powder form, or dehydrated potatoes, meats. Your chipped beef was dehydrated. So you had just a hodgepodge of stuff coming from the States. But if a cook could land himself with some fresh beef from a village, eggs, flour from a flour mill. If he could get his hands on it, he fixed it for the troops. Fresh produce, vegetables, fruits. He was always looking for something out of the ordinary, and that just boosted the morale of the men in his company. Okay, so they were always looking for different ways and scrounging for different things that they could fix. But in 1937 stove like mine, you can cook anything in the field that you can cook in your house, barring any refrigeration. Now, we have refrigeration because we use the Mermites. So, but I stick with the World War II cookbook. I've got a hardback copy that the cooks used when they went to cook school. Then you have the little manual, the field manual, paperback, but it's got all the recipes. It's just condensed. So anything I cook in the field for my men comes out of a World War II cookbook.
Now, when it comes to you and when you guys are doing your reenactments and the living history events, obviously you kind of condense your menu options because, one, you got to buy all this stuff. Two, you got to pack it across state lines. And three, you're trying to keep it simple, stupid. So what is your go-to menu items for, let's just say, a Saturday and Sunday event?
Well, we do... I always get, like I was talking earlier, I buy eggs from a farmer, but I don't have him clean them. And this is what a lot of people don't know. If you don't wash an egg right out of the nest, the chicken nest, you can put it in a crate, a box, pad it, and that egg will stay good for up to 3 weeks. As long as you don't put it out in real hot sun or in sunlight, we always keep them underneath our mess fly or keep them in a tent. To where sunlight doesn't hit them, and we've used eggs 4 and 5 days in the field, and we don't clean them until we're just ready to use them for whatever, baking. So one of my go-to things in the morning is we'll make up biscuit dough, we'll bake biscuits, big pot of SOS, big pot of coffee, and scrambled eggs.
You were telling me before you came on,